What's going on, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to another episode of Polititeen. If you are new here, Polititeen is a podcast that hopes to spark political conversation in our youth by talking about current politics with people that are currently politically active. With that being said, thank you for tuning in to today's episode, and as always, happy listening. And we're rolling. Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Polititeen. I am Damien Galvin, as always, joined by my co-host, Varun.
Hey, guys. My name is Varun Kadathala. I am the co-host of the Polititeen podcast here with Damien. Here, we at Polititeen try to spark political conversation amongst youth and young voters in today's nation, young minds, and inspire political activity and civic discussion. Now, that said, today we have a very special guest on our podcast, Dr. Kavanaugh, and she works with the RAND Corporation's Truth Decay Initiative to kind of bring light to fact-checking and really the biases in today's media sources and information sources. And we're so excited to have you on, Dr. Kavanaugh, today. If you'd like to introduce yourself to some of our viewers.
Hi, I am Jennifer Kavanaugh. I am a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation in Arlington, Virginia, and I'm really excited to be on this podcast today to talk about our work on Truth Decay, what it means, and what we're doing about it, and what you can all do about it.
Now, Dr. Kavanaugh, our first question for most of our guests is usually how they got started in the political field, but it's going to be a little bit different for you because you're not, per se, a politician, but you definitely do work in the political spectrum. So how did you get started, involved with politics and involved down, the career choice that you're in today?
Well, I majored in political science in college, and I started working as a research assistant for a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. And he was a professor of social policy. And so I did research for him on the history of the U.S. Maritime industry. So looking at data on the salaries paid to longshoremen in the 1920s and things like that. And I just found the process of research to be a lot of fun. And I decided that it was something that I could maybe do for my career. I was really indecisive in college. I decided for brief periods of time that I wanted to be just about every profession that you could be. So I decided that after college, I would take some time to work and try things out before I went to grad school. And I got a job working as a research assistant at the RAND Corporation, which is a nonpartisan public policy think tank that does research and analysis to inform policymakers. So I worked there for 3 years on a range of different, mostly national security focused projects, especially a lot of things on the military personnel policy, terrorism, so a whole range of different topics. And I really just fell in love with the process of research and especially working at RAND and the ability to do research that is policy relevant and that you see around you and having an impact every day. So after working at RAND for about 3 years, I decided I would go back and get a PhD in political science. So I did that. And I really went back with the intention of coming back to a place like RAND or to RAND exactly to continue this type of policy relevant research and analysis. I was never really interested in going into teaching in academia. Although I love teaching, I really wanted to be able to have an impact and be involved in the policy world. So that's what I did. I came back in 2011, and I have been here since working on, again, a range of different topics. National security focused, but then over the past 5 years, since I've been working with my partner, Michael Rich, on this project, looking at Truth Decay and its implications for the policymaking process and American democracy.
Right. And I think that, countering truth decay and also kind of political and national safety is also kind of correlated. And I'll talk about that later, my perspectives on that. But before I talk about that, I wanted to kind of mention a personal question for you, Dr. Kavanaugh. And that is, when I posed a question to my parents about pursuing the political science pathway in college and poli-sci as a major, they were like, Varun, you can't get anywhere with that. And they were like, there's no places for advancement and a career in poli-sci. And you're kind of a testament to how people can advance from that profession and that kind of study to a very stable profession and a place in life right now. And I wanted to ask you, what do you have to say to students like myself who aren't sure about whether they're going to go into poli-sci? What kind of opportunities does it provide and opportunities for advancement especially?
Well, I think that studying political science is really a launching point to any number of different fields. And you can take political science in so many different directions. I mean, there's ways of studying political science that are very quantitative. So that's the approach that I've taken, is to take a lot of different, political economy classes, to take statistics, econometrics, and things like that. So you come out of school not only with a grounding in political theory and an understanding of how institutions work, but also with, quantitative skills, qualitative methodologies, survey methodologies. And so I think that it's a launching point for any number of different types of graduate programs that you might want to go to. I mean, someone coming out of college with a political science degree, you can get jobs working in a political field, but you're also highly competitive to work in any number of other fields, like consulting, because it teaches you a way of thinking. I have friends who went into investment banking because they were able to understand how international economics works. You can go in and then you can go to graduate school, like go to law school or business school. So really, I think that from the perspective of someone making a decision about what to study in college, it's really about, and for graduate school too, it's less about the topic and it's more about learning methodologies for approaching and tackling questions and ways of thinking, so that you're able to then decide how you want to take those tools and those skills and apply them to different fields.
Definitely. And I think that the application of the tools and skills and methodologies that you learn in colleges, especially fact-based career paths like scientists today, are being undermined greatly. And you mentioned this a lot, through your research. But I wanted to ask you, what is kind of this recent attack that we've seen by this administration on scientists? I mean, they have stated that they're not going to let science get in the way of them reopening schools, and there's been attack on personal science or personal attacks on scientists. Do you think that this is a proper way forward? Do you think that these attacks have any sort of validity?
Well, I think that people come to a distrust in science from a number of different places. Certainly, from my vantage point as a scientist, as someone whose life is based on data and thinking about data to answer questions, it's not an approach that I would take to tackling questions. It's also not an approach that historically has led us down good policy paths in terms of achieving the outcomes that we want. I think that people distrust science for any number of reasons. There's some group of people that may distrust science because science is naturally something that evolves and changes. As we get more data, as we get better methods, we learn new things. So things that we thought were healthy for us in the past, we learn are actually not healthy for us. Drugs that we thought worked, we learn actually didn't work. Just like evolving understanding of how COVID spreads, right? We thought that COVID spread mostly on surfaces. Now we know that it spreads mostly through air, right? And that's not scientists being wrong per se. It's about us learning. But that can sow distrust because people aren't steeped in the scientific process, who don't have experience with it, may not understand how knowledge evolves in that way. So that's one group of people. There's another group of people who may distrust science because it's inconvenient, because they have a set of outcomes that they want, whether they're economic or political, and science doesn't support those outcomes. And so in that case, the denial of science is really a way of pursuing personal objectives and pushing aside anything that's inconvenient. And I think that is much more dangerous, right? Because we can teach people about the scientific method. We can explain to them that, just because we thought coffee was good for us yesterday, we've learned this new thing about coffee that's not good for us today. Yeah. And tomorrow it'll probably be good for us again. So just, wait a day, right? we can understand like that. That's one issue. The issue of people purposely pushing aside science or purposely manipulating information, right? A lot of the science around climate change that we had decades ago was manipulated in order to tell one story. And now we find out that actually, that was false information information that was only telling part of the story, right? So that's something very different and something that's much more damaging and much harder to counter.
Right. And I think that you bring in every single perspective that I had written down to talk to you about. I was going to talk to you about climate change and how it's an inconvenient truth, as Al Gore said it, the global warming crisis that we're having in today's world. And it's really inconvenient for a lot of people. I've been a strong believer, Dr. Kavanaugh, that people don't believe in climate change because it's more convenient for them, like you said. I think that people want to have that future no matter what the truth behind the issues are, and they're going to achieve that future and pursue that future no matter what the issues are. So I guess my question to you is, we talk so much about how it's inconvenient that vision for some people, and the truth is inconvenient for some people. How do we make sure that people understand that we need to move forward from that inconvenient truth and to create the future, not by ignoring the facts, but by addressing the facts and working to overcome them? You know, I think it's really hard to convince some of my friends who don't believe in climate change and really facts like that of the issues that we have at hand, you know, of the crisis that we have at hand. So is there any way that we can really, really make the people focus upon the facts? Because I feel like it's hard when their minds are so closed off.
Well, yeah, I think you're absolutely right that it is very hard. And I think I would say two things. I think the first thing is that one of the reasons why it's so hard to change people's minds is because people anchor on information and they like to be right. Like, we don't like to be wrong as human beings. Right. We like to be right. And so it can be hard to change people's minds because they will always search out those facts that confirm their beliefs. And that makes it harder to change people's attitudes about different issues. It's also hard because anecdotes and things that have emotional relevance are much more powerful generally than data. So if you cite a bunch of facts or statistics about climate change, but someone has some personal experience or was told by a really close friend or a really close relative a different story, those things may have more emotional power for them than the facts that you're presenting. And so I think one of the challenges that we face as researchers, and something that my colleagues and I at RAND are always thinking about, is how do we present facts and technical information in a way that's as emotionally resonant as an anecdote about, you know? And I think that's really hard. And so I think part of it is about storytelling and communication. I think part of it is about who the messenger is, right? So right. If you go into some, if you have nothing in common with someone and you're telling them that they're wrong, that may not be the most effective way to communicate with them. You need to get someone who they consider a peer, who they trust, who can provide them that message in a non-threatening way and help to change their thinking about that. So it's about storytelling, it's about messenger. And then the third thing I think is that anytime we can point to consequences, it can be really valuable. So, you know, if we can show what are the consequences of ignoring the facts and data, right? And I think that COVID actually is a really good example, because the consequence of ignoring the facts and data about COVID is that you could die. So that's a really clear and final consequence, right? And so I think that when we have such a clear stepping stone, right? You go out into a crowd of, you know, however many thousand people with no mask, and then you wonder why you get COVID. Well, the data told you that this is what you had this risk, right? So I think that when we think about communicating it, right, it's partly about how we communicate, but I think having this consequence, being able to show when we ignore data, the consequences are bad. Not all the time, right? It's not a simple one-to-one relationship, but we can show that data helps us to make better decisions about risk. Maybe you still go to that event with a couple thousand people, but you wear a mask, right? Or you accept the risk. Data helps us to make those trade-offs. And having a clear sense of what the consequences of ignoring data are, where you can point out in kind of stark terms, that can be a powerful communication tool.
Definitely. And I think that oftentimes, even if you choose to not believe the data, I think maybe the best course of action for a lot of people would be, okay, maybe I don't believe this, but what are the consequences if it turns out to be true? And I think a lot of people ignore that for political gain or political, pursuit of trying to send a different political message. And I think that that's very dangerous right now. So I guess my question is, what are the facts showing right now in terms of what we should do to really kind of, move forward as a nation in all different fronts?
Well, I think one really significant stumbling block here is the extent to which we live in polarized communities. Yeah. Because we live in these communities that are very homogenous within the community, but very isolated then from other communities outside who might have a different perspective. And so what I mean is, you know, you end up living in a community where everyone who lives around you probably has the same kind of economic status. They probably do the same things in their leisure time. They go to the same schools, they go to the same religious institutions, right? So you're probably has similar political beliefs. So you are constantly getting one message and one narrative. And what that does is it allows narratives to thrive within small communities, but not be challenged by those outside narratives. And so you see that, I think you see it in climate change, you see it in when we're talking about immigration, when we're talking about healthcare, people's understanding of issues is really narrow because they see it within their insular worldview and they get it from their specific news sources, but they're not getting the full perspective. And so we have very different experiences. It's hard to tackle issues like climate change, like coronavirus, like immigration, if we don't have a shared set of facts that everybody has as a starting point for the conversation or for the policy debate. Because without that shared set of facts, it's hard for policymakers to talk about trade-offs. It's hard for policymakers to debate policy options. And we certainly can't make sustained progress. Like, tackling these issues is not, well, hopefully COVID won't be like an 8-year challenge, right? But these other issues are like, they're not going to be solved. Immigration is not going to be solved in 2 years or 4 years or 8 years. Neither is healthcare, neither is homelessness. So these things require that we have a set of facts that can endure past one Congress, past one presidential administration. Without that, which I don't think we can build successfully without breaking down some of these boundaries between communities, then I think the path forward is harder.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you said is absolutely right. Facts make up the backbone of perspective. You know, we can't have educated perspective without having these baseline facts. You know, I think what you said about people being in their own bubbles, you know, with political standpoints and their overall status, it kind of causes privilege in our nation. I've experienced it as well. You know, I've been in a kind of bubble of being in a high class community, a suburban community in Atlanta, and I've not really seen other kinds of communities and had that own privilege. And now that I'm looking at Black Lives Matter and really getting educated on that, I'm seeing that I'm not, you know, everybody around me is not everybody in the world. There's other places to where people can be advanced. And it's almost like, you know, what you're saying is almost like you're in a faulty relationship with somebody and you don't understand the flaws and you refuse to accept those flaws. You know, it gets progressively worse, right? It's going to get progressively worse. So I think that that's the issue we're facing right now. But my question to you, you know, following upon Damien's point earlier, is that, you know, people have asked me, you know, Varun, you're big on politics, big on the news. What are some social media and news channels that I can watch to where I don't have a partisan perspective, you know, Democrats, Republicans, where they both present the facts instead of presented perspectives and more of a bipartisan perspective. So is there any news channels that you've seen over your years working with misinformation, disinformation that do that? Is there any way that people can get only the facts and nothing but the facts?
Well, I mean, I think it's hard. First of all, everyone has biases. No matter how hard you try, you're going to have biases that are baked into how you see the world. So I think that's kind of the starting point. I think the second thing is that increasingly we see media outlets that blur the line between facts and opinion. So even stories that are purportedly providing you facts have analysis in them. So example would be things that are labeled like news analysis. That is like some facts, but also some perspective. And it's not always clear which is which. And I think that makes it challenging. For me, what I try to do is just consume a diverse set of news sources. So I don't rely on one source. I, you know, will read multiple different sources on the same issue and just try to be like consume everything, you know, look at things that are on the left-leaning side, look at things that are right-leaning, look at things that are center-leaning, look at opinion pieces, look at news wires, which are probably the closest thing you're going to get to straight news reporting.
Right.
And then synthesize your understanding of an issue based on that. Now, of course, that's time consuming. You know, it's hard to have the time to kind of sit down and sift through all that. So you probably can't do it on every issue. But on issues where you really want to understand something in depth, that's really what you have to do. And then, you know, failing that, if you don't have time to do that on every issue, for other issues, you know, just understand the biases of those places where you're getting information, or choose a couple, choose one left-leaning and one right-leaning and read them both to balance each other out.
Yeah, I think that the most unbiased place that you can go to for news is probably Polititeen. I don't know if you guys have heard about it. It's a really good podcast. No, I mean, even here on the podcast, we definitely have opinionated segments, and I definitely have my own opinions. But I think what's important is voicing those opinions and saying, hey, like, I'm speaking from a place where I have this bias, but here are the actual facts, and here are how, you know, I might interpret the facts. But you have to distinguish those lines and say, you know, this is an opinion, this is a fact. And it becomes very difficult when you have different news outlets that are trying to either play one as the other, or play the other as, you know, a fact. So it becomes a position where you have these very blurred lines. And I think that one very interesting point that I've always seen these blurred lines on is like political polls. I don't really necessarily understand how political polls work, and I don't know if you necessarily have any insight on them, but you know, I always see either a CNN poll or a Fox News poll or all these different polls, and is there like, do these pollings take place in individual places? Is this like a general thing? Are these online?
Well, so there are some polls that are online. Typically, there's a number of different ways that surveys work. So most of the polls that you see, so there's some surveys that are done online. The good online surveys are ones where you build a panel. So you recruit a group of 3,000 or 5,000 people. Those people are recruited to be nationally representative. You make sure they all have internet access. So there may be some people of that 5,000 people who didn't originally have internet access. You give it to them. And then you provide them a tablet or some other means to fill out your survey. Right. So it's not like I'm putting out, like, it's not like a Twitter poll, right? It's like, it's internet based, but it's a more reputable methodology. So other polls, they still use phone calling. So they'll use like random digit dialing to call people, ask them a battery of questions, and get the information that way. So those are probably like two common ways that polling is done. Obviously, there are issues with both methods. Obviously, the issue with calling people is that not everyone has like a landline phone, and even if they're calling cell phones, like how often do you pick up a phone from a number you don't recognize, right?
Yeah.
So obviously there are biases, and obviously this is why polling is sometimes criticized. This is why sometimes polls are wrong and people speculate about why they're wrong. Well, their sample was biased. When someone says the sample was biased, it just means they didn't reach a nationally representative sample and they assumed it was, right? So maybe they use only phones, they use only landlines. That sample is going to be biased. It's going to be biased because you're not going to get any young people who has a landline, right?
Oh, okay, yeah.
I don't even remember the last time I had a landline, and I'm kind of old, and I haven't had a landline for like 20 years, right? So there's going to be biases in that way. I think the key thing to understanding surveys is, number one, to understand that samples can be biased and sometimes in pernicious ways that you might not notice. The second. Yeah. So you may think you have it, but you may think you're getting the right answer, but it may be subtly biased. For example, a lot of polls are only polling like what they consider to be likely voters. And that's based on a methodology which they use to figure out like who is likely to vote based on your characteristics, because certain types of people are more likely to vote than other people. But if you hit a certain election that motivates a new demographic that isn't considered a likely voter, you're going to miss that whole demographic.
That's interesting.
And so you're not going to poll them. Yeah. They're going to show up. Your polls are going to be wrong, and you wouldn't have known it until election day. So that's one thing to keep in mind, is what's the sample and what are the possible biases. Another bias that sometimes people talk about is like people who lie, like if they don't want to admit something on a survey, right? And this is a concern when you poll people about things like experiences of violence or drug use. Like, right. Do I really want to admit those things to a pollster? Maybe not. And so the results might be biased by my self-reporting bias, like I'm lying. And then the third thing to keep in mind is the margin of error. And margin of error is based partly on the sample size, how many people you poll. So the bigger your sample, the more confident you can be that your sample is actually capturing a real result. Whereas if you only poll a small number of people, there's a lot more uncertainty about your poll results. And so if you see a number like 31%, let's say it's like 31% for one candidate or one issue and 35% for the other, but the margin of error is like plus or minus 7.
Yeah.
Well, you can't really say anything about that because those margins of error are overlapping. And so I think those are the key things to think about, is number one, could this sample be biased? And number two, what is that margin of error? And I think a lot of times people don't understand that polls can be affected by those types of things. And so you can put too much stock in them. And the other thing is just polling changes all the time. So really you're looking for trends over time, not just one poll.
Oh, what you said about polling. I mean, personally, I've seen Trump polls online, and they've been kind of targeted towards Republicans. You know, we see his image and saying, are you Republican? Do you support socialism? And so they're very, very, themed towards attracting that electorate. And so it kind of skews those results more so. And even on the Democratic side, I've seen polls like that as well. So I think we have to consider where we get our information and use that kind of platform to analyze our polling. But I wanted to ask you about one thing that's kind of personal to me, and that's social media. You know, I understand as a teen and as a politteen here that Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok and all these major media platforms like Facebook, they all use a certain algorithm which pushes forth the most outrageous and the most out there content to the front view, makes that the most popular content. Now, what that does is I've seen content like, for example, during the Black Lives Matter movement, there have been white nationalists creating Antifa accounts to promote looting, you know, to falsely promote that ideal in the name of Black Lives Matter. We've seen videos from 10 to 15 years ago with the Black Lives Matter movement push forth as live content. You know, it's been a lot of misinformation in today's world through these false accounts because of social media. Now, I wanted to ask you about social media platforms like Twitter, Facebook, using third-party fact-checking, because I feel very strongly about this. I think that it is a way to move forward in constricting upon free speech, but promoting free speech, free expression. And there's been people on both ends who said that fact-checking is a way to constrict the American free speech value. You know, our president came out a couple of months ago and said that it was, unpatriotic and anti-conservative. So what is your approach on how effective fact-checking and flagging via social media is, and if it's a good thing for our nation going forward, or if it's a bad thing to tell people what content they should worry about?
Well, I think that fact-checking is better than nothing. There's certainly, I don't think there's like a negative side to fact-checking, at least on the side right. of flagging accurate information. I think there are limits on how effective fact-checking can be. The first is just the volume of false information that's out there. I think that most of the highest quality fact checkers are humans, and humans can only process so much information at once. Right. And so even hiring thousands of fact checkers, it's still only like a drop in the bucket of how much disinformation is out there. So I think if you're going to use human fact checkers, the only thing you can really do is prioritize the things that are most dangerous, right? COVID misinformation or misinformation that's going to end up causing violence or causing harm to somebody. There are fact-checking tools increasingly being developed that work on machine learning or AI. And so that is much more efficient in terms of being able to process large amounts of information, but much less effective because it can't necessarily capture the context that a human could. And so it can end up flagging things that are accurate because it misses the context or vice versa. Fact-checking is also the evidence on whether or not it actually changes people's minds is mixed. There is some evidence that certain types of people are open to receiving new types of information. So a fact check in that case could help them to correct their view. But as we discussed before, there's a segment of people who are very resistant to changing their mind, even when presented with contradictory information or corrective information, especially when that corrective information doesn't come from a trusted source or from someone that they feel is like them, or in a way that they find to be kind of like an attack that puts them on the defensive. Right. So the effectiveness of fact-checking is mixed. The amount of information that fact-checking can like effectively process is more limited than the amount of disinformation out there. At the same time, you know, I think that information that is objectively false, like we should be able to flag that information. I don't think that is infringing on free speech, especially if we're not even taking it down or just flagging it to say this information is false or you should investigate this further.
Yeah,
I think it's a little bit tougher when we're talking about things that are misleading or out of context or only tell part of the story. We may want to flag those things because they tell a story that's incomplete and that leads people to the wrong conclusion. But there's nothing false about what they're putting there, right? It's just out of context or misleading. And so that, I think, warrants a different kind of treatment. Maybe the response there is also to label something, but to label it as misleading or to provide a link to additional information or something like that. But I do think that, you know, obviously we don't want to infringe on free speech. It's one of the most important things that we have in the U.S. It's one of the things that sets us apart, even from Europe, in the sense that we just, that the government cannot infringe on freedom of speech. But at the same time, the current media environment, especially social media, is right now has basically no guardrails and no governance mechanisms. And in that way, it's different than television and radio and newspapers. All the other ways in which we consume information have governance structures, not censorship, not restrictions on free speech, but governance that helps to manage the information space. We don't have any of that in social media. And I think it's worth having a discussion about what those governance mechanisms would look like. And maybe fact-checking is one piece of that.
Yeah.
Right. And I mentioned to people that it's the age of misinformation. You know, before now we had the age of information with more information, more content coming out. Now I think it's the age of misinformation, almost like the Gilded Age during the U.S. history curriculum. I compared to that during my analysis. And I resonate with what you said, especially the fact that, you know, fact checking is not an infringement upon free speech, but more so, I think that personally it is a bolstering of free speech, because you're not eliminating the content, but you're kind of giving it a second review and making sure people get the right information into their minds. Now, I'm going to let Damien continue. Just a couple points for me.
Yeah, no, definitely. I agree with Varun 1,000% that getting at least different perspectives of information is very important. And I think that that's the thing. I think that, you know, facts are always going to be objective, but I think that people are always going to be able to manipulate them in a sense that they're subjective. And that's always the bad rap that politicians have gotten, that they've been able to do that and they've been doing that for however long. But I think that the way that you can avoid that is by looking at different people's perspective and seeing that objective facts, regardless of how you look at them, are always just going to be there. And how you use that data is really where it matters. So once you begin to see other people's perspectives, you can just start looking at the difference between subjective and objective a lot more easily. So that's what we hope to do by bringing other people's perspectives onto this. But kind of going back to just the idea of straight data, is there any sense that the data itself is being, I wouldn't say manipulated, but it's being corrupted in a sense that these companies are, you know, you have Trump doing his own polls and different organizations doing their own polls. Is there any way that we can move away from that and kind of have a unified polling mechanism, I suppose? Is there another country that does that? Does Europe do that?
Well, I think all countries have a lot of different, like, polling companies and polling methodologies. So I don't know if there's a country that has like one polling outlet. I mean, I think in Europe they use, I think it's like Europol or something like that, which has a lot of their data. And so that is sort of a more centralized approach with one methodology. You know, I see the appeal. Certainly we'd like to get rid of the polls and the data that's bad, right?
Yeah.
We'd like to eliminate information that is objectively false, that is using bad methodologies, that is manipulated. You know, we'd like to get that out of the data ecosystem. On the other hand, it's useful to have kind of different methodologies and different cuts at a specific issue. Because if every methodology, small changes on methodologies are giving you really different results, that tells you something. It tells you that things are still really uncertain and really messy. But if lots of different methodologies are giving you similar results, well, that tells you that there's actually a lot of certainty in what you're seeing. So I don't think that having different methodologies is the problem, or having different data sets or different cuts of the data is wrong or is a problem. But I do think that having people who are willing to manipulate and lie about their data, that's problematic, because that kind of corrupts the system. And it's not just political actors that do that. We know that there are researchers who have fabricated data to write a paper to get it published, right? That's the whole false story about vaccines causing autism was based on false data. And then the article was published in a medical journal. It was later retracted and the guy lost his medical license.
Yeah.
But it was out there. And once it's out there, we can't pull it back.
Yeah, yeah. Well, wasn't that article meant to show that autism, that it did cause autism, that vaccines did cause autism, but it actually proved the latter, that it didn't?
Well, because the data was false, so it was manipulated. So I mean,
okay.
The article argued that vaccines cause autism, but since the data was manipulated and made up, there's no truth to that, and there's dozens and dozens of studies showing that there is no connection between vaccine and autism. So it's been like, you know, it's been clearly shown that this is false.
Yeah.
But people anchor on it, and people use it as people who don't want to who want to believe that vaccines aren't safe. Use that as their anchor point, right? There's many reasons why people might not want vaccines, and that is, you know, what they provide is their rationale.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it comes down to closed-mindedness. You know, how open-minded can you be with regards to policy? I think that I've been a pretty open-minded person. I like to just read about different perspectives. Before every podcast, I go on sites like Politico, Real Clear Politics, Fox News, CNN, to bring in different perspectives, like you said, about certain issues. But I think part of the issue right now, Dr. Kavanaugh, is that you know, polls and things like that not only flub up data, but sometimes they erase data and you know, it purposefully keep out data. For example, during yesterday's interview with President Trump from George Wallace, I believe, on Fox News, we saw that after the interview, Fox News said that the Trump data left out certain countries' deaths with regards to the coronavirus COVID-19. And I think it brought in the perspective to me that the people are leaving out data purposefully. And that's also a form of misinformation that we should focus upon. So, Is there any kind of way that we can fact check information on that regard, on that front, you know, leaving out data as opposed to making up data deliberately?
Well, I think that if we look carefully at graphics that were presented, it, you know, we can identify problems with it. I mean, you know, during the period of the pandemic, I've seen a number of different ways that different states have tried to hide their numbers, right? Like changing the ranges so that, like, on this graph, the blue color is 1 to 100. And on this graph, the blue color is actually 1 to 1,000, right? So, like, the small manipulations, I've seen states that have reordered their dates so that the dates no longer appear in chronological order, but you see then the downward trend that they want to show.
Yeah.
Right. But if you just take a quick look, and this is the same thing with reading news articles, if we're lazy and we just kind of skim through or just look at the figure without actually carefully reading a legend, without questioning information, without thinking, wait a second, does that even make sense? Right?
Yeah.
Without taking the extra time to check that information, cross-check it against a different source. If we don't take that time, then it's really easy for us to fall prey to false information. And so part of this, there's a range of different responses and ways that we, or things that we could do to get us out of this age of disinformation, as you put it. But one of them is on our own individual responses and taking the time to fact check things, to not share information. Like, don't share a story if you haven't actually read the story, right? Check and make sure that it makes sense and that it's actually seems like something that you want to share with your friends and your family. Take a second look at that graphic and see, does that make sense, right? Because these are all things that we can spot ourselves. We may not have been trained to look for them in the same way that we've been trained to, like, read graphs in school, but we can take that extra time. And so I think the biggest step we can take to identifying places where data seems to have gone missing or is to just take that extra step to look for it, right? We won't notice it's missing unless we take the time to investigate and to question and to really think about it.
Yeah, well, you know, we've talked about the different forms of data, and I guess a less formal question would be, what's some of the, like, weirdest interpretation of data that you've seen, or the weirdest manipulation that you've seen throughout your whole career that you can really recall?
I mean, certainly some of the changes have been very interesting. I think reordering bars out of chronological order so that they trend downward was interesting. I mean,
yeah.
I think some of the more interesting things are just different things that people do in, you know, when you're doing statistical analysis. I tell my students, I teach at Georgetown, I tell my students that once you understand statistics, you can make data tell you almost anything that you want.
Yeah.
If you know what you're doing,
wow.
You can manipulate them in a way to tell the story that you want to tell by excluding different outliers or you know, running a specific type of model or including or not including a control variable. And so I, you know, I've done some work looking at, I think probably one of my favorite was looking at this one paper where the author had estimated some relationship, and he used a cut point for the end of the Cold War that just made no sense.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't actually match up with when the Cold War ended. And so when I took his data and reran it using like a date that made more sense as the end of the Cold War,
yeah,
all his results went away. So it was really clear that he had chosen that date just to get the result that he wanted. And that's just a good reminder that, like, you know, even things you read in academic journals can be misleading. Now, you don't always have the time to go and redo their analyses to see what's misleading, yeah, but you should always be questioning, right? The red flag for me was reading the paper and seeing that the Cold War was coded as ending in, I forget what year it was now, like 1985. Like, the Cold War didn't end in 1985. No. So, like, you know, I was like, okay, I need to investigate, like, why would he choose this ridiculous date? So I think it's just looking for, like, red flags like that.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that I was talking to my grandpa yesterday about how stocks and companies flub up data and make them kind of employ certain trends to make sure that people are buying or not buying stocks. And he was talking to me about how you got to look deeper, you know, you got to look deeper into what a company's trying to portray via statistics. And I think that what you're saying is completely relevant, whether it's economics, stocks, business, or politics. I think statistics can show what companies or people want them to show and nothing else. And I resonate with that. I think that people should do a deeper analysis of what they're looking at and even look at sources that do deeper analysis of information and not necessarily get their viewpoints from, you know, a group chat or just a fake kind of communication source. Because it's easy, I think, it's easier than people think to see what's fake or not. Because yeah, I feel like it's pretty obvious in some circumstances and sometimes not. And that's the problem here, you know. And sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's not, and it's really hard to see what's fake and what's not, and that is a real scary thing about it in today's world. I think that I love what you're talking about today. I want to ask you specifically about what the Rand Corporation does with the Truth-K Initiative and what especially they do with research and how we can kind of get into contact and help you out by reading your articles and getting more information from you guys.
Yeah, well, so Rand Corporation is a nonpartisan public policy think tank. We do research and analysis to inform policymakers on a range of issues, everything from national security issues, which is what RAND is probably best known for. That's what RAND started doing, to domestic issues like healthcare, education. We have a whole stream of work on coronavirus, things like that. So it's a very broad. We publish about 1,000 reports a year.
Wow.
And they're all available for free to download on our website, which is www.rand.org. We have three offices. One's in California, one is in Pittsburgh, and one is in the DC area in Virginia. And in terms of the Truth Decay Initiative, we started in 2015 or 2016, looking specifically at the role that facts, data, and analysis play in our political and civil discourse and in the policymaking process. And so we're looking at this from a really broad and diverse range of perspectives. Thinking about the cognitive bias angle, so how we process information, thinking about the media landscape, both traditional media as well as new media, social media, things like that. Thinking about education, so media literacy, civic education, and how those can help us to teach people skills to tackle these challenges, and then political polarization. And we published our first report in 2018, and since then we've done a whole range of spin-off products, including additional research reports that look at things like how news reporting has changed, that dig into topics like media literacy and how people consume news. We have some new things out on civic education. We have a database that we built that's tools to counter disinformation online that are available largely for free that you can download, things that you could use to, say, detect bots or fact-check information.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And again, all of this information is available on our website. We have a specific page for the Countering Truth Decay Initiative. I can send it to you guys if you want to then provide it to your users, but you can also easily find it by on the RAND website by just searching for Truth Decay. You'll get to it. And then that landing page has all of our products. So all of the things that we published, as well as blog posts, articles, interviews, podcasts, a whole range of different resources. There is like a contact box. So if you want to send me a message, you can do it that way, or you can email me. It's easy to find my email address online by looking me up on the RAND website.
Yeah, definitely. And we'll definitely be sure to get that out to our listeners. You guys will be able to find that on our Twitter. And I think that in the description of this episode, we'll probably list it somewhere. So definitely be sure to go and check out all these amazing resources. It's really incredible work that they're doing and something that is more than necessary in today's day and age. I think an interesting question, I don't know why this just popped up in my mind while you were talking, but you often hear, you know, it's the joke that 80% of statistics are made up or 80% of whatever is made up on the spot. Would you be able to put a number on how many stats are actually like made up or how many stats are kind of swayed in your personal opinion? Or maybe you do have some like analytical reading of how stats are made up.
I don't think I could put a specific number on it without contributing to the number of statistics out there that are made up. So I'm not going to put a specific number on it, but I think it goes back to this idea that like statistics are easy to manipulate.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that we shouldn't trust them, but we have to understand what's underlying them. For example, like denominator makes a big difference, right? So one of the reasons why we aren't able to give a good fatality rate for COVID is because we don't know how many people are actually infected.
Okay.
Right. So that denominator matters a lot. So as the denominator gets bigger, the fatality rate can go down even as actual deaths increase.
Okay.
And so just understanding that like so many things can affect statistics, depending on what field you're talking about, things like temperature can affect statistics and who you actually sample can affect statistics. And so I think it's just understanding that like statistics is about probabilities and probabilities can be influenced by so many different things. That doesn't mean that we ignore them. That doesn't mean that we don't trust them. It just means that we have to understand our context. And I think that in general, people are not statistically literate in the sense that like we don't have a good understanding. First of all, people struggle with like numeracy generally, but statistics is especially hard, especially when we're talking about like things like risk. People are very bad at judging their risk, right? Like we're really worried about like shark attacks, but shark attacks are really, really rare. So we don't need to spend so much time worrying about shark attacks. Or terrorist attacks, right? Like you're more likely to be struck by lightning than killed in a terrorist attack. But we worry about terrorist attacks because we hear about them on the news, right? So there's all these ways in which our mind plays tricks on us, especially with numbers and especially with statistics. And I think that's why we have to be careful when we're like analyzing them and interpreting them, that we're really being careful in that interpretation.
Yeah, most definitely. Most definitely. I don't know where Varun went, but I'll continue here on the next point. I think that it definitely is important to kind of understand the different ways that stats can be manipulated. But is there? Oh man, I kind of just lost my train of thought there with Varun disappearing. Pardon me, but let's see. Okay. This is a question that I had earlier. National security. So on the front of national security, you kind of had the whole TikTok discussion. I don't know if you're really intertwined with what's happening there on social media, but I guess it could sway away from necessarily just TikTok. But do Chinese entities, enterprises really pose a threat to American national security?
Well, I think that any entity that's trying to collect data on U.S. citizens in any kind of way, whether it's through social media or some other means, can pose a risk to national security. You never want to have your personal data floating around with other. And you know, we already know that China has, you know, been behind a number of different hacks where they've tried to steal information of U.S. citizens, whether it's Marriott or the OPM hack, where they stole a lot of information from government employees and government contractors. So we know that that these, like, when they are able to amass large databases of information, that just it can't be good, right?
Yeah.
So TikTok and Twitter and Facebook, like when you use these things, you leave behind tons of fingerprints every time you post things, whether it's photos or tweets or where you were or videos on TikTok, whatever it is, and all those things then can contribute to this like digital footprint that you leave. And the more data out there, the easier it is for someone to kind of like reconstruct your profile and then potentially use it for kind of nefarious purposes, whether it's just simple identity theft. Well, not that that's simple, but like identity theft, or whether it's something much more nefarious. So you can imagine in the context of some kind of conflict, imagine if you were getting like text messages that some people in your family were in danger, right? Because they were able to know kind of where you lived and who your family members were, right? So the more information they have again about you, the more able they are to manipulate in that sense. And so I think in any way that we provide kind of like footprints around, we have to be careful. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to never use these platforms, but you do want to be careful about how many you're using and what kinds of information you provide. Like, for an example, Twitter is always trying to get me to provide my birthday. And I'm just like, no, you don't need to know my birthday. So I'm not going to put it in there, right? But every time, and it's the same thing, like anytime we enter our birthday on anything online, right? We're leaving these little footprints around, these little cookie crumbs that someone else can pick up. And you can do that, but you just have to be cognizant of the fact that you are leaving them.
And a lot of people aren't, you know. I think the data is the most beneficial gift that we have, and also the most scary thing that we're seeing today. I mean, I think people don't understand the implications of having their data everywhere online. You know, on the topic of data, I want to talk to you about, I'm forgetting my talking point here, but I just wanted to mention how scary that is in today's world to have so much data outside. You know, I was searching up my mom's name yesterday on Google, you know, and I found a White Pages document with almost everything about her. And it's like, how does the entire world have access to information about my mom? And even myself, for that matter, the more information that I put online, the more information people can get about me. But I think that what some people fail to understand is sometimes the benefit of having some data put into sources for our own personal safety and awareness. We were talking about Damien and I on the last podcast about how Apple is going to start, and they have started already, having a log of people who've used their platform and had the coronavirus. And so people can see if I've come into contact with that person over the past couple of days, you know, the past couple of 14 days before they got the virus. So it kind of safeguards us from the coronavirus, this kind of data collection pool. So there are some benefits towards it. Now, on the topic of data and people remaining cognizant about what data is put out there and what data is kept inside, I want to ask you our final question that we ask all of our guests. And that is, you know, what is one quote, one saying, or one phrase that you would say to young voters, young minds who are watching our podcast today?
One quote. Does that have to be someone else's quote? One?
Your own. It's very free form.
Yeah. Okay. I think that voting is the most powerful tool we have for change.
Yeah.
If you're not happy with how things are, you can vote and try to change it. You may not always get your way. That's part of a democracy, is that sometimes, you know, the majority chooses something different. But if we're not out there, if we're not participating, then are we really living in a democracy? You know, if people aren't voting, then what is it? I think if you care about your world, if you care about what happens in your future, then you have to vote, because that's your chance to have a say. Otherwise, you're just abdicating that to other people. And we know, like, we know that the people who are, we know that young people vote at lower rates than older people, right? But it's the younger people whose futures are, whose like long-term futures are at stake here. So, you know, we all have to get out there. You know, we all have a stake in the future. So that's all I would say, is that it's your chance to have a say.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
You know, we've got to do better as Generation Z. I agree. The past generation, as Damien and I have been talking about, has not been the most politically active, educated about technical issues. We got to do better.
Yeah, definitely.
I agree. Yeah. Since I think there's a generation between you guys and me, so we can say that the generation ahead of you guys and behind me.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it goes on to social issues, but we also need to start paying attention to the facts and how voting can definitely affect that. But we want to thank you for coming on, Dr. Kavanaugh. It was really a wonderful podcast, and you're extremely insightful on a array of issues. And once again, thank you for joining us. I think our guests would love it. Anything else? Any final sayings, Rune?
No, I had a lot of fun. I love talking with you guys. So thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. We hope to have you back on.
I'd love to come back.
And for all of our viewers, make sure to follow us on Twitter at Politateen Show. And stay tuned for this episode. In the next couple of episodes, we have a couple of exciting announcements that we'll shoot to you guys during today's outro. And as always, thank you for watching this podcast, and stay tuned for more.
Hello, everyone. everyone. Thank you so much for watching today's episode of the Politeen Podcast. As always, we appreciate and thank you for your support over these past couple of weeks as we've grown as a podcast and as a duo between myself and Damien. And please follow us on Twitter at Politeen Show. And always, as always, make sure to follow us on Instagram at Politeen Show and to connect with us via email at politeenpodcast@gmail.com. Make sure to check out our newly hosted website at politeenpodcast.com. And lastly, please consider becoming a sponsor, a donor for our campaign on Patreon. You can get a link to that through our website at www.politeenpodcast.com. And through becoming a sponsor, you can get some amazing exclusive perks, such as a way to contact us for questions, suggestions, becoming part of an exclusive community where you can kind of talk about your political viewpoints and ask questions of our guests as they come on, you know, live streams of us talking, and even posters, stickers to rep Politeen. So as always, have a great rest of your day, and thank you so much for your support over these past couple of weeks. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Thank you so much.